Welcome to Base by Base, the paper cast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So, I mean, we've always been taught the central dogma as this strict one-way street, right?
Right. Yeah, the classic model.
Yeah, like DNA is the master architect. RNA is just the, you know, passive instruction manual or messenger. And proteins are the heavy lifting workers that actually carry out the biochemistry of the cell.
Exactly. That's day one of biology class.
Right. But what if that instruction manual isn't just passively sitting there waiting to be read? What if the manual is actually, I don't know, bossing the workers around?
Which is a wild concept to wrap your head around.
It really is. I mean, how could this flip our understanding of everything from how our cells survive starvation to, well, how we fight off viral infections? And what really happens when metabolic enzymes, proteins that are supposed to be busy digesting sugars, suddenly moonlight as RNA binding proteins?
It completely shatters that one-way street model we've relied on for decades. I mean, we are looking at one of the most significant paradigm shifts in modern molecular biology.
Wow. Okay, so this is huge.
Oh, absolutely. And before we dive into the mechanics of how this works, today we celebrate the work of researchers at the European Molecular Biology Laboratory, or EMBL, and the Center for Genomic Regulation, CRG, who have fundamentally advanced our understanding of the RNA-bound proteome. They've introduced us to this entirely new concept called riboregulation.
Riboregulation. Okay, let's unpack this shift for everyone listening. To appreciate why this new research is turning the field upside down, I guess we have to look at the classical view of RNA-protein interactions first.
Right, the baseline. Historically, we knew about roughly 1,000 of these so-called classical RNA-binding proteins, or RBPs, in mammalian cells.
And their roles made perfect sense within that standard model, right?
Exactly. They splice RNA transcripts, they transport them out of the nucleus, they facilitate translation at the ribosome. Standard maintenance stuff.
Right. And the defining feature of those classical RBPs is their structure. They have these highly specialized, evolutionarily conserved modules called RNA binding domains, or RBDs.
Yeah, we're talking about well-documented structures like RNA recognition motifs, KACE domains, helicase domains, things that are explicitly folded just to grip nucleic acids.
So if we think of the cell as this massive manufacturing plant for a second, these classical RBPs are the specialized factory workers.
I like that analogy.
Thanks. So those RNA binding domains are their bespoke tools, like a wrench or a soldering iron designed exclusively for handling the factory's primary product, which is the RNA.
Precisely.
And a worker carrying a wrench isn't going to suddenly start, you know, balancing the factory's accounting books. They stick strictly to their biological mandate.
That is the perfect framing. But here's where it gets interesting. Uh-huh. Massive advancements in proteomic screening have effectively tripled the number of known RNA binding proteins over the last few years.
Tripled. Wait, really?
Yeah, tripled. We went from a specialized cohort of 1,000 to thousands upon thousands. And this new massive group is what the field now calls non-canonical RBPs.
Okay, and here is the plot twist for you listening. These non-canonical proteins aren't some mysterious, uncharacterized novelties emerging from, like, the genomic dark matter.
Oh, not at all.
Right? These are some of the most well-studied, famous proteins in biology, but they're known for doing completely different jobs. We're talking about core metabolic enzymes like GAPDH, which drives glycolysis, alongside various membrane channels and signaling molecules.
Yeah, totally familiar faces.
And crucially, they completely lack any of those known RNA binding domains we just talked about.
Which created a massive conceptual problem, right? Because for half a century, the structural assumption was that binding RNA in a meaningful way required those specialized domains.
Right, you needed the wrench.
Exactly. So finding thousands of metabolic enzymes and ion channels physically clinging to RNA was just baffling. It seemed completely orthogonal to their day-to-day metabolic functions.
I would assume there was a high degree of skepticism from the scientific community here, because if these enzymes don't have the specialized hands to grab RNA, and their main job is processing metabolites, I mean, we have to rule out accidental collisions.
Oh, for sure. The cytoplasm is an incredibly crowded environment.
Yeah, it's a dense molecular mosh pit. So how do we know these enzymes are genuinely interacting with RNA rather than just, you know, bumping into it in the chaos of the cell?
Well, the standard biochemical assays couldn't really answer that, which logically led researchers to a much more definitive technology. The gold standard that proved these interactions are real and pervasive is in vivo UV crosslinking.
Okay, shining ultraviolet light directly onto living cell cultures. I know UV light is highly reactive, but how does it separate a real functional interaction from a random microsecond collision in that mosh pit?
So the photochemistry of UV crosslinking is actually remarkably precise. UV light creates covalent bonds only at what we term zero distance.
Zero distance, meaning they have to be literally touching.
Exactly. It physically fuses the uracil bases of the RNA directly to the amino acids of the protein, but only if they are intimately structurally engaged at that exact fraction of a second.
Yeah.
If they are merely floating near each other, the reaction just doesn't happen.
Oh, wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. And furthermore, unlike chemical crosslinkers, you know, like formaldehyde, UV light has almost no tendency to crosslink two proteins together. It specifically targets and freezes that RNA-protein interface without creating a massive web of false protein-protein artifacts.
So the UV light instantly freezes these physical connections in place, but now you just have this frozen, tangled mess of cross-linked RNA and proteins locked inside an intact cell.
Right, a total mess.
You obviously have to lyse or break open the cell. But how do you actually fish these specific complexes out of the cellular debris to sequence and identify them?
Well, researchers developed some incredibly elegant capture methods for this. The foundational technique is RNA interactome capture, or RIC. Yeah. This utilizes microscopic magnetic beads coated with oligo-DT, which are basically short strings of thymine nucleotides. These thymine strings hybridize with the poly-A tails found on messenger RNA.
Ah, okay, so like a molecular magnet.
Basically, when you magnetically pull the mRNA out of the cellular lysate, any protein covalently cross-linked to it just gets dragged along for the ride.
Okay, that makes sense for capturing messenger RNA, but that only represents a fraction of the transcriptome. If you want to study non-coding RNAs, you can't use a poly-A bait.
No, you can't.
So how do you separate cross-linked RNA protein hybrids from the thousands of unlinked proteins and unlinked RNAs without relying on a specific tail?
That required a leap in chemical separation, resulting in methods like OPS, or orthogonal organic phase separation.
OPS, great acronym.
Isn't it? OPS doesn't rely on sequence pait at all. It uses a mixture of water, phenol, and chloroform to separate molecules by their distinct chemical properties.
Oh, taking advantage of the fact that the cross-link molecule is a hybrid, so pure proteins would partition into the organic phase, while pure RNA partitions into the aqueous phase, which means the UV cross-linked complexes must get trapped somewhere in the middle.
You've hit the nail on the head. Because they are a chemical hybrid, they partition directly at the interface between the two liquid phases.
That is so clever.
It really is. They form a distinct, visible disk that researchers can carefully extract, capturing all RNA species, not just mRNA. And, you know, if the goal is to observe what non-canonical proteins are binding to freshly transcribed nascent RNA, researchers use a metabolic labeling technique called EU labeling.
EU labeling. I assume EU stands for ethanoluridine.
I got it.
So you feed the cells this modified RNA building block, the RNA polymerase incorporates into new transcripts, and then you use bioorthogonal click chemistry to attach a biotin tag to that ethanol group. And that allows you to pull out only the brand new RNA.
That is the exact mechanism, yeah. Using these highly specific isolation techniques, the evidence just became irrefutable. These metabolic enzymes are absolutely physically binding to RNA inside living cells.
Right. And here's where the biophysics of this gets fascinating for this deep dive. Because we can chemically prove the binding occurs, but, you know, if I superglue a coffee mug to my forehead, it doesn't mean the mug is helping me write an email.
Right, right.
It just means it's stuck. So how do these non-canonical proteins physically hold the RNA without standard domains, and what actually happens to the protein's function when they do?
Well, to understand the binding mechanics, structural biologists had to look beyond rigid 3D pockets. Since these proteins lack classical RNA binding domains, they utilize highly unconventional surfaces. Nearly half of the RNA binding regions identified on these non-canonical proteins are intrinsically disordered regions, or IDRs.
Intrinsically disordered regions, meaning they lack a fixed tertiary structure. I imagine them functioning almost like a molecular liquid rather than a rigid keyhole.
A molecular liquid is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. IDRs are highly flexible, unstructured stretches of amino acids that are unusually rich in charged or aromatic residues.
So they don't have a specific shape.
Right. Rather than providing a rigid slot for the RNA, they act as a dynamic sheath. They dynamically mold around the RNA strand, utilizing electrostatic interactions to maintain a grip.
Wow.
And other non-canonical RBPs take a different route. They borrow domains originally evolved for entirely different biochemical tasks. The Rossmann fold, for example, is a classical ancient structural motif designed to bind metabolic cofactors like NAD plus whales.
Oh, I know the Rossmann fold, so they use that for RNA.
Exactly. It turns out that the electrostatics of that pocket are remarkably adept at accommodating RNA as well.
So they are structurally moonlighting, using dynamic electrostatic sheaths or repurposing a metabolic pocket, which leads us directly to the core discovery of the paper, the functional consequence of this finding. This is the paradigm shift known as riboregulation.
Yes. If we zoom out and look at the functional data, the realization is that RNA isn't merely being acted upon, transported, or spliced by these proteins. The RNA is actively regulating the protein's biochemical function.
The instruction manual is actively dictating the behavior of the factory workers in real time.
Precisely.
Let's ground this in the biology with some specific, memorable examples of riboregulation, because the sheer variety of mechanisms here is just stunning. Let's start with protein-protein interactions and the autophagy regulator P62.
Okay, so autophagy is a critical survival mechanism. It's how a cell degrades and recycles its own components to survive severe stress or starvation. For autophagy to initiate, the P62 protein must physically aggregate or oligomerize to form the scaffolding for this recycling machinery.
Makes sense.
But under nutrient-rich, healthy conditions, a small, non-coding RNA known as Vault RNA11 binds directly to the P62 protein.
So the RNA is functioning as a molecular bouncer. It physically parts itself on the interaction interface of P62, sterically hindering it from oligomerizing with other P62 molecules.
Exactly like a bounce.
But the moment the cell experiences starvation, the transcription of Vault RNA11 drops. The bouncer leaves the door, P62 is suddenly unhindered and free to oligomerize, and autophagy is immediately triggered.
The elegance of that system is profound. It's a rapid, signal-responsive switch controlled entirely by fluctuating RNA levels.
That's amazing.
And we see an equally impressive mechanism in direct enzyme inhibition. Let's examine SHMT1, which is a vital metabolic enzyme that converts the amino acid serine into glycine, feeding the one-carbon metabolic pathway.
And this specific enzyme operates structurally as a tetramer, right? A symmetrical complex of four protein subunits working together.
Correct. Structural analyses revealed that the messenger RNA of its mitochondrial counterpart, a related enzyme called SHMT2, binds directly to this SHMT1 tetramer in the cytosol. But the binding site's what makes this extraordinary.
Where does it bind?
The RNA binds to a highly flexible flap that sits adjacent to the enzyme's folate binding active site.
Oh, so it's not simply plugging the active site like a competitive inhibitor, it's binding nearby, which implies an allosteric mechanism. By binding that flexible flap, the RNA must be exerting physical torque on the protein structure.
Yes. That physical torque cascades through the tetramer and causes a distinct allosteric shift. It chemically distorts the geometry of the active site so significantly that serine can no longer fit into the pocket. The enzyme's cleavage activity is entirely halted.
So the RNA acts as a highly specific allosteric volume knob. It dials down the enzyme's activity by warping its functional shape.
Exactly.
And this inhibitory action scales up dramatically, doesn't it? The authors describe a glycolytic enzyme called ENO1 that experiences a phenomenon they term crowd control.
Oh, I love the crowd control concept.
Yeah, instead of one specific RNA transcript acting as the volume knob, ENO1 is broadly inhibited by thousands of different RNA transcripts binding to it simultaneously, creating immense steric drag.
Right, the collective mass of the cellular transcriptome essentially slows down that specific node of the glycolytic pathway. But, you know, riboregulation isn't exclusively inhibitory. RNA can also serve as a structural foundation.
That's it.
Under severe cellular stress, such as serine deprivation, long non-coding RNAs transform into physical scaffolds. The transcript glycoline NC is a prime example of this constructive riboregulation.
So if the cell is starved and needs to maximize its metabolic efficiency, glycoline C acts like a molecular party promoter. It doesn't just bind one protein, it physically tethers multiple distinct glycolytic enzymes, pulling them all together into a massive localized supercomplex known as a metabolon.
That's a great way to put it. By physically gathering these sequential enzymes into a specialized microcompartment, the RNA facilitates substrate channeling.
So the product of one enzyme is immediately handed off to the next.
Exactly, running the metabolic pathway at maximum possible efficiency to protect the cell's energy supply. Furthermore, we observe this RNA-driven metabolon formation in both human cell lines and in yeast. which strongly suggests we are looking at an ancient, highly conserved evolutionary mechanism.
Wow, okay, so we have RNA acting as a steric bouncer, an allosteric volume knob, and a metabolon scaffold. But there's a final example from the paper that extends this regulation into intracellular logistics, specifically transmembrane transport into the mitochondria.
Yes, this involves the ATP5A1 protein. It's a critical nuclear-encoded subunit of the ATP synthase machinery that must be imported into the mitochondria to function.
And what does the RNA do there?
Researchers discovered that the cytosolic import of ATP5A1 is physically facilitated by its binding to cytosolic messenger RNAs. The RNA interaction is an absolute prerequisite for its efficient translocation across the mitochondrial membrane.
So the RNA acts as a VIP pass, structurally stabilizing or guiding the protein so it can cross the velvet rope into the mitochondria.
That's exactly it.
I mean, looking at P62, SHMT1, glycolamine C, and ATP5A1, the functional versatility of riboregulation is just undeniable.
It is undeniable, but, you know, it still faces intense scrutiny. A rigorous scientific community demands that we question the biophysical reality of these interactions, especially regarding phenomena like the crowd control scene with EL1.
Let me channel that skepticism for a second. A critic might look at these non-canonical RBPs and argue that these IDR-mediated interactions are just low-affinity, non-specific molecular static.
Right, the noise argument.
Yeah. If an intrinsically disordered region is just a flexible charged string, it might weakly stick to any RNA it bumps into without any true sequence specificity.
That is the dominant critique, and the researchers definitely anticipated it. First, to rule out artifacts of UV cross-linking, these interactions are rigorously validated using orthogonal assays.
Like what?
Well, they employ proximity ligation assays, or PLA, where antibodies equipped with DNA strands only generate an amplified signal if the RNA and protein are physically touching in an uncross-linked living cell. They also use NMR spectroscopy to map the physical binding interfaces in real-time solution.
So the bindings are definitely physically real. But what about the argument regarding low affinity? If the grip isn't incredibly tight, does it still count as specific regulation?
This requires us to separate the concepts of affinity and specificity. Non-canonical RBPs generally exhibit lower binding affinity than a classical RNA recognition motif. They don't lock onto the RNA with the same immovable grip.
Okay, that makes sense.
However, a lower affinity interaction can still be exquisitely specific.
Right. It's like a highly complex magnetic lock. The magnet itself might not be overwhelmingly strong, the affinity is low, but the geometry of the lock is so precise that it will only engage when the exact specific key is inserted.
That is exactly the biophysical reality here. Even EN01, which binds a wide array of transcripts, exhibits two orders of magnitude greater preference for its specific target RNAs compared to non-target background RNA.
Wow, two orders of magnitude.
Yeah, that differential proves it is selective functional regulation, not just random electrostatic clinging.
Which brings us to the ultimate so what? If riboregulation is this ubiquitous, the clinical implications must be staggering. We aren't just talking about abstract cellular metabolism anymore, we are talking about human disease.
The clinical landscape is vast. When researchers cross-reference these newly discovered non-canonical RBPs with the OMEN database, the primary catalog of human genetic diseases, the data is alarming.
Really? How so?
The mutation rates in these non-canonical RBP domains are extraordinarily high, mirroring the mutation rates seen in critical transcription factors. This strongly implies there's a massive, unexplored territory of genetic diseases that are currently misunderstood.
Oh, I see. We might be attributing a pathology to a broken metabolic enzyme, when in reality, the disease is caused by a broken RNA-protein riboregulatory interface.
Exactly. And the virology implications are equally profound. We now have structural evidence that when RNA viruses like SARS-CoV-2 or chikungunya infect a human cell, they actively hijack the host's metabolic enzymes.
No.
Yes. The virus repurposes our core metabolic machinery to serve as viral RNA binding proteins, utilizing our own biology to stabilize and replicate the viral genome.
Which presents a completely novel therapeutic vulnerability, right? Because if pharmacologists can design small molecules that specifically disrupt the virus's ability to riboregulate our host enzymes, we could halt viral replication without damaging the host cell's baseline metabolism.
Precisely. And speaking of RNA-based therapeutics, we have to discuss the role of riboregulation in mRNA technology.
Oh, this connects directly to the mRNA vaccines. The fundamental hurdle of that technology was getting synthetic RNA past our innate cellular immune defenses.
Right, and those defenses are heavily mediated by non-canonical RBPs. Take 2IM25, an E3 ubiquitin ligase that functions as a primary antiviral sentinel.
Okay.
2IM25's physiological role is to recognize foreign, unmodified RNA and trigger an intracellular cascade that degrades the transcript. However, researchers discovered that 2IM25's RNA binding is highly sensitive to specific biochemical modifications on the RNA strand.
So it's looking for specific markers.
Exactly. If a transcript incorporates a modification called N1-methylpseudouridine, TRM25's binding affinity drops to near zero. It leaves the RNA completely alone.
And N1-methylpseudouridine is the exact synthetic modification bioengineers utilized in the COVID-19 mRNA vaccines.
You got it.
So the entire success of the vaccine platform hinges on manipulating that specific riboregulatory interface, ensuring TRM25 ignores the therapeutic payload.
Exactly. The future of mRNA medicines will rely completely on mapping and manipulating the riboregulatory dance between therapeutic transcripts and host defense enzymes.
That is just wild. But, you know, taking a step back from the modern clinical applications, I keep returning to the evolutionary timeline. We are seeing metabolic enzymes regulated by RNA in everything from simple yeast to human cell lines. It forces you to ask why.
It really does.
Like, why would an enzyme evolve to cleave serine or process glucose, simultaneously evolve to be structurally warped by an RNA transcript?
Well, it leads us directly to one of the most compelling concepts in evolutionary biology, the RNA world hypothesis. This posits that billions of years ago, before the evolution of complex proteins or double-stranded DNA, RNA was the sole macromolecule of life.
Right, because it catalyzed reactions and stored information simultaneously.
Precisely.
So you're suggesting that riboregulation isn't a new adaptation at all, it's a molecular fossil.
Yeah.
When proteins finally evolved and took over the heavy lifting of cellular metabolism, the primordial RNA didn't just cede control.
The evidence suggests they co-evolved. As proteins became the dominant metabolic workers, RNA maintained its primordial regulatory grip. It utilized flexible IDRs and repurposed cofactor pockets to tune and adjust enzyme activity, ensuring the metabolic output perfectly matched the transcriptional state of the cell.
It entirely rewrites the central dogma we started this deep dive with. We aren't looking at a rigid top-down hierarchy where proteins dominate passive RNA transcripts. We are looking at a deeply intertwined pas de deux, a sophisticated mutual dance where RNA and proteins are constantly communicating, leading, and responding to each other in real time.
I couldn't have said it better. If we synthesize this entirely, the central insight is this. The functional RNA binding proteome is vastly larger and more structurally diverse than we ever anticipated, encompassing critical metabolic and structural proteins.
RNA is not merely a passive messenger.
Exactly. It is a powerful, active regulatory entity, a riboregulator, that continuously shapes protein conformation, metabolic flux, and cellular survival.
It fundamentally changes how you view the molecular machinery of life. I mean, what does this mean for our understanding of the origins of life? If RNA was the original master regulator in primordial cells, we have to wonder how many of our modern, intractable metabolic diseases are actually caused by a subtle breakdown in this ancient, highly conserved RNA protein dance. It's something to think about the next time you look at a textbook diagram of a cell. This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Like gravel, I can't understand. Zuff in the margin, ZGW in the haze. Still I feel a signal in the noise of the page. If the ink won't speak, I'll listen to the beat. If the lines are torn, I'll find what they repeat in the missing reason.